doing a series at the moment called the Yogi's Joy, and we're talking about the songs of Milarepa. So I'll say a bit more about him as the evening progresses. But before I do that, I just want to start with one of his songs. So I'm going to read this twice. So this is called The Eight Reminders. Castles and crowded cities are the places where now you love to stay. But remember that they will fall to ruins after you've departed from this earth. Pride and vainglory are the lure which now you love to follow. But remember, when you're about to die, they offer you no shelter and no refuge. Kinsmen and relatives are the people now with whom you love to live. But remember that you must leave them all behind when from this world you pass away. Servants, wealth, and children are things you love to hold. But remember, at the time of your death, your empty hands can take nothing with you. Vigor and health are dearest to you now. But remember, at the moment of your death, your corpse will be bundled up and borne away. Now your organs are clear, your flesh and blood are strong and vigorous, but remember, at the moment of your death, they will no longer be at your disposal. Sweet and delicious foods are things that now you love to eat, but remember, at the moment of your death, your mouth will let the spittle flow. When of all this I think, I cannot help but seek the Buddha's teachings. The enjoyments and the pleasures of this world for me have no attraction. I, Milarepa, sing of the eight reminders at the guest house in Garakashi of San. With these clear words I give this helpful warning. I urge you to observe and practice them. So I was going to read that twice, but it's a bit strong, isn't it? So I'll probably just stay with the once. I think once is enough, actually. So those are some words from Milarepa, and I think that gives you a sort of a tantalizing taste of how wondrous and uncompromising he was as a teacher. So he lived in the 12th century in Tibet, and he was an important teacher in the Kagyu lineage, which came down to us through his teachers, Naropa and Tilopa, and he passed on the lineage to Gampopa, and that's come all the way down to modern day Tibet. And the modern day Karmapa Lama, who some of you will have heard of, is from that lineage. So the Kagyu lineage, Kagyu means whispered lineage or whispered tradition, because in that tradition they transmit the Dharma in a close context, in one-to-one context with pupils. So it's a direct transmission of the Dharma. And he's an amazing teacher, an amazing character, a very, very inspiring figure. So the tradition has it that he lived for a long time as a hermit. He lived in a cave, and legend tells us that he survived on a diet of nettle soup, just nettles and water. And he must have been quite a character to meet. So this evening we're going to hear about an encounter between him and a member of the laity, a young nobleman. And when Milarepa's described, he is often described as being green in colour, because he lived on nettle soup. I remember watching an episode of an old TV program called The District Nurse when I was a child, and there were some children that turned orange in that from just eating carrots. So it's just sort of a Tibetan equivalent of that. He was green, and he had this waxy complexion. So quite a character to come across. And tonight we're going to meet him and see what happens with this encounter between him and the young nobleman. So where we find him is on his travels on the road in Tibet, and he's woken from a dream. So he's been in a very special state, in the dream state of a yogi. It's said that there's a system of practice called Tibetan dream yoga, where yogis work in dreams to realize the truth, to realize the Dharma. And he's just woken from a dream, and he's walking down the road, and he meets this young nobleman. And it's worth just thinking for a moment about what this nobleman might have looked like. So if you can, imagine a very handsome young man with long black hair, with a bushy moustache, with fine clothes, with a sword, perhaps on horseback or next to his horse. A very, very, very impressive figure. So that's who Milarepa meets. So if you can hold that in your mind, it must have been quite an encounter between this man and this waxy-looking kind of goblin-esque figure, really. So he's walking down the road, Milarepa's walking down the road, and he meets this young man. And he immediately sees something in him. His mind is so highly developed that he recognises that this is no ordinary young man. He can see some potential in him beyond him being a nobleman. So he decides to engage this young nobleman. When I read this chapter, what came to my mind is that he's sort of playing with him, in a sense. He decides to engage him, and he has this wisdom at his disposal. He has his realization, his knowledge, his wisdom. He has all of these things at his disposal, but he plays with the young man a little bit, and he sort of acts up as a character a little bit, and plays on the fact that he's an old man, and that he probably looks quite unusual. So he asks the young nobleman if he will take him across this river nearby on his horse. He says, "Please take me across, because I'm just an old man. You can see I'm bent over. I'm not fit anymore. I'm not young like you are. So please just take me across the river." But the young nobleman's not having any of it. He doesn't see Milarepa for who he is. To him, he just looks like this shriveled up old character. And what he's thinking of, what's in his mind, is that he wants to just get on down the road and meet his friends. So he's on his way to a party. He's a very handsome young man. He wants to do what all handsome young men do. He wants to probably go and drink and see his friends. And he's not having any of it. So he says, no, I won't do that. I won't take you. I'm sorry. But what impresses Milarepa is that actually he's just very clear. He doesn't sort of say, "Oh, well, I'd really like to, but I feel a bit torn," or "You seem really nice." And he's just very, very clear. He says, "No, I'm not going to do that." So Milarepa pulls out an ace at this point. And his response to that is, basically, he floats off into the air. So he floats off into the air, and he floats to one side of the river, and then he walks across the river. So he walks on water, basically. So this isn't a conventional approach, is it? What we try and do at the London Buddhist Centre to get someone interested in the Dharma is we hold open days, we invite people to meditation classes. But Milarepa's part of the tantric tradition, and he's not going to take this approach. So this is typical of the tantra. He goes straight for the jugular, and he flies off, and he walks on water. So in the Buddhist tradition, we talk about great and...
Can you just turn the lights
off? Up a bit, yeah. So in the Buddhist tradition, we talk about great teachers having what we call siddhis, or magical powers. And what Milarepa's doing is he's using his siddhis to attract the young man, to pique his curiosity. So it's what we call skillful means, really. The tradition's very strong on not using these siddhis purely to impress people or for worldly gain. But what Milarepa's doing is he's ensnaring the young man. It's like he's seducing the young man. He's not going to let him get away that easily. So of course the young man's gobsmacked. He can't believe it. You know, here's this young, frail, this old, frail-looking man, and suddenly he's flown off and he's walked across the water. But he's a very straightforward man, and he's not going to be taken in that easily. So he asks him some questions, and he wants to be satisfied that he's not just pulling a fast one, or it's not some sort of magical trick. But when he realizes that actually what's happened has been a genuine feat of his city's, he's really, really interested, and that has a strong effect on him. So it's like he has a realization about who Milarepa is. It's not a full realization yet, but he begins to see him more for the great teacher, the great guru, the great yogi that he is. And at this point, as is traditional in Tibet at this time, he asks him who he is, where he comes from, and who his teacher is. So Milarepa recounts his story. He tells him about how, as a young man, he was cheated out of his inheritance. This is Milarepa's story. His aunt and uncle cheated him and his mother out of their inheritance. And to get his revenge, he learnt the black arts from a sorcerer. So he learnt black magic, and he caused a huge amount of damage with these skills. So he caused the death of lots of people. He caused hailstorms, which caused crops to fail. And he had the responsibility for causing a lot of harm and a lot of suffering. But at a certain point, he went to a teacher and he saw the error of what he'd done. He saw the error of his ways very clearly. And he decided to make amends. So he set out on a quest to find a realized being who could help him to purify his karma. And he knew that this teacher would have to be the real deal, the real thing, because his only chance was to gain enlightenment in this lifetime, if he was to stand any chance of turning around his past and purifying his karma. And he found his teacher, Marpa, who was a realized teacher who helped him to do that. And he underwent an incredible amount of trials and suffering, and Marpa knew that he had to completely break down Milarepa and completely get him to start again before he could teach him the way to the Dharma. So legend has it that he had him build these huge structures of 9, 10, 12 stories. One of these structures that was apparently built by Milarepa still stands in Tibet today, and it's this huge, great big building. And what Marpa used to do was he would get him to build a building, and then he would say, okay, knock it down again, and he would have to knock it down again and start again. And apparently he was so exhausted by this work and so worn out that he used to have massive, great big blisters and welts on his back, and at the end of the day he would cry to Marpa's wife, Mrs. Marpa, and he'd say, you know, please, I can't do this anymore, I can't. And she'd say, look, he wants to teach you, just stay with it. You know, you need to do what he tells you. And eventually he received the Dharma. So he had an amazing story. And the boy at this just recognizes who Milarepa is. He says to him, you are the sage unrecognized, a man of the beyond. You're a Buddha whom one meets so rarely. So in this realization, he bursts into tears. It's like something has happened in the young nobleman. And Sangharakshita, in the commentary on the text, it's very lovely actually. He talks about how the young nobleman is able to see who Milarepa is because of his mind being purified. So it's like there's a recognition. Yeah, there's a recognition from something from the young nobleman to Milarepa, so it's not just a one-way process. I'm going to read what Sangharakshita says here. He says, this recognition is not only of the teacher, but also of something deep within the young man himself. The meeting with Milarepa has confronted him with something he hadn't known was there, except that at some level, part of him must have known that it was there all along, which is why it's not totally unfamiliar. It's a moment of insight, a recognition of his true nature, and in as much as it's in its contact with Milarepa that's put him in touch with that deeper level of himself. It's as though he's known Milarepa before too. The two recognitions are inextricably connected in the young man's experience. Milarepa is, in some sense, that deeper level of himself. But what does this mean? So it's interesting, this idea, isn't it, that when we recognise something in the Dharma, or when we come across a teacher, or we hear a particular text that activates something in us, it's not just what's happening externally, it's something in us that is ignited. I was thinking about this when I was putting this talk together. I was thinking of a couple of examples. One was, there's a retreat centre that I go to regularly, and there's a teacher there who I have an enormous amount of respect for, a tremendous amount of reverence for, and my experience of being on retreat with him is, he's a magical man, a wonderful character. He gives these incredible talks, and he's a wonderful teacher, and I feel a lot of reverence and a lot of gratitude towards him. And I once had the experience of bumping into him on the way back from a retreat at the local train station. And it was interesting, he looked different to me. What was funny about it is he actually looked a lot smaller. And I thought, oh, you look smaller than you do when I'm on retreat with you. He was sort of buying a paperback, and he was just going to visit his family. And it's interesting, he was the same person. But somehow... and he still looked like a lovely man, and very friendly, but somehow he was different outside of that context slightly, and I was different outside of that context as well. And he looked and felt slightly different to me. It was very interesting. And I was also thinking as well about when the first time I went on the LBC's winter retreat. Yanavacha was leading the retreat that year. And there was one evening where he read from a poem by Edwin Arnold, The Light of Asia. And I'd heard that poem many times before, and I'd read it myself many times. But something in that experience at that moment just activated something in me. And I just started crying. It wasn't necessarily just the poem, it wasn't the way Jnanavacha presented it. It was something about those conditions coming together that lit up something in me. And this is the sort of experience that this young nobleman is having, but possibly much more profound than that. So his response to that is one of, gratitude and intrigue. So he wants to know who Milarepa is, and he feels this sense of devotion. So what he does is he offers Milarepa something. He offers him his horse. And, it's hard for us to imagine what that means, actually. So it's not, in those times in Tibet, a horse wouldn't have just been a horse. It would have been something of great value. They're the only mode of transport in Tibet, or they were at that time. It would be a status symbol for a young nobleman. It would be something of tremendous value. And he offers it to Milarepa. What do you think happens? Any ideas? Anyone? Yeah?
Does it grow wings?
That's a very good guess. No, it doesn't, but it doesn't grow wings, no. Milarepa refuses. And in true Milarepa fashion, he refuses through a song. So We're studying the songs of Milarepa, and he was famous for just spontaneously bursting into song. His heart was so full of joy that pretty much whatever he did, he would have a song for it, and it would just emerge spontaneously. So he turns down this gift of a horse, and this is what he says. He says, I won't sing because I'm not a very good singer, but I'll read what he says. He says, a horse of Pranya mind have I. I adorn him with the silk scarf of Dhyana. His skin is the magic ensuing Dhyana stage. His headstall is the prana of vital force. His forelock curl is three-pointed time. Tranquility within is his adornment. Bodily movement is his rein. And ever-flowing inspiration is his bridle. He gallops wildly along the spine's central path. So what he's doing there is he is, he's refusing, isn't he? And he's giving the young man a teaching. So he's communicating via the gift of his song. And what he's doing is he's deepening the young man's experience of actually who he is by taking what he says and completely turning it round. You know, he's basically saying, I don't need your horse. I have everything I need. I have my own horse. I have the horse of the Dharma. It's more beautiful. It's more vital. It's faster. It's more wonderful than anything you could possibly imagine. So this is what happens in this episode, is that it's like at each time the boy is more intrigued by what Milarepa says. So he has to offer more. He feels like giving more. It's like, okay, I want to offer more to you. I'm more intrigued each time. And each time Milarepa refuses him. So it's interesting also that the way he takes what the nobleman is offering, he takes a symbol of who the nobleman is and says, well, I've taken that and I've transformed it. I have all those things, but I've transcended them. So it's not that I don't have them, it's like I contain all of those things and much, much more. And in the commentary, Sangharaksha talks very, very eloquently about this and how this relates to the experience of enlightenment. So I'll read you what he says. Enlightenment is dependent on energy being totally available on all levels, and within the Tantra this becomes the main focus of one's practice. Nor is this an exercise in abstract wish fulfillment. It's worked out in the concrete details of everyday existence. If there are energies that are not going along with what you're essentially trying to do, even though they may not actively hold you back, they will nonetheless tend to sit like a dead weight on the energies that are actively trying to take you forward. The Tantra is designed to address this fundamental problem of the spiritual life, which is that you can make quite a lot of effort and still get nowhere. So it's interesting how that relates to what Milarepa's doing, isn't it? He recognises that this young nobleman has a lot of energy, and he doesn't see that as a hindrance. He actually sees it as a gift. He sees that he's straightforward, that he is fiery, that he's young, that he has lots of energy. And what he starts to do is show the young nobleman a way that he could possibly begin to transform those energies. So Sangharakshita says, liberation is essentially about liberating energies, which means experiencing them more fully. One of the ways we repress energy or lock it away is habitual patterns of thought, feeling and behaviour. If Buddhism is concerned with bringing about the direct experience of oneself in the very depths of one's being, it does so by bringing into consciousness this submerged energy of which we are usually unaware. So what he's saying there is it's not a case of just trying to completely leave our lives behind and suddenly take up a completely new way of being. It's like we have to bring all of our energy and all of our vitality, but also all of our difficulties and all of our issues or the things that we think might be holding us back onto the path with us so that they can be transformed. And he talks about the importance of doing that and not, well, not doing what I was saying before about not just deciding that we have this idea that to be a Buddhist we need to be a sort of a good person or to be this sort of calm, quiet, you know, whatever these stereotypes that we have. He's talking about actually bringing all of our energy and transforming it. Yeah, so Sangha actually talks about how we can transform that energy. So he says you want to get rid of negativity but retain the energy tied up within it. There's a lot of energy in anger, for example. You might even say that anger is raw, crude energy, and you can't afford to throw it away simply because it's tainted with ill will. Unfortunately, this is what often happens. The energy is thrown away with the negativity, which is perhaps why so many religious men and women, although they're good people, seem rather weak and bloodless and incapable of saying boo to a goose. So he's not one to mince his words, is he? Sangharakshita, he tells it like it is. And when I read that, I found it very refreshing, actually. Found it very refreshing. Because it put me in mind of my sort of early experiences in the spiritual life, which was when I was a teenager. And I'd had some experiences when I was in my teens of, well, I don't know what they were really, but of having a sense that there was more to life and having some very strong experiences of opening up to something bigger than I was, feelings of sort of seeing the interconnectedness of things, of feelings of bliss. And I grew up in a small town in the north of England, which we didn't, there wasn't really much in the way of alternative religious traditions up there. So being brought up in a Christian culture, though not a Christian household, I sort of thought, oh, you know, I've been touched by God or something like that, so I better go and find myself a Christian group and see what they've got to say about it. So I started going along to the local Methodist church, and I was so disappointed by the people that I came across there, because there just didn't seem to be any sense of the vitality that I've been talking about. There was no oomph. Everyone was really nice and very well meaning actually, and very, you know, they were doing a lot for the community, and but it all seemed a little bit sort of grey and lifeless. Yeah, so I sort of didn't stick with that very long. I sort of drifted off. And it's because I was looking for something more. I was looking for a sense of energy, you know. Perhaps if one of them had flown off and started walking on water or something, I might have been a little bit more drawn in. But yeah, that was my experience. So to get back to our nobleman, he goes a step further. And what he does is he looks at Milarepa. He can see that he doesn't have much in the way of clothes. He's not really protected, so he's just wearing a white loincloth. And so he offers him his boots. He hasn't learned from the first refusal that Milarepa gave, but he offers him his boots. And of course Milarepa turns him down with another song. He says, I cut my boots from the hide of the renunciation of samsara, and with the leather of awakening from transiency and delusion, I made my boots with the craftsmanship of deep faith in karma. With the dye of non-clinging to the myriad forms, and with the thread and rope of devotion. So again, he's turned him down, and he said, well, I have what you have. but more than you can imagine at the moment. So I'll see your boots and I'll raise you my dharmic boots. That's essentially what he's saying. And there's something symbolic in here as well, that, you know, in those days a pair of boots would have been sort of tied on and bound to the feet. And this offering marks a stage in the move of the young nobleman towards Milarepa. So it's like, to move towards the spiritual life, he'll need to start to bind himself to it through the acts of devotion. So Sangharakshita says, devotion is the function of binding oneself to one's ideals with vows of dedication. So it's appropriately compared with bootlaces. So it's like devotion is the binding. He starts to move towards Milarepa. So what he's trying to do is he's seen something in Milarepa, and it may be that what he's seen is this going beyond ego in Milarepa. This practice which. Sangharakshita says in the text is nothing to do with feeble sort of self-effacing or anything like that. It's a fiery, vital representation of the spiritual life. So he says, getting rid of ego clinging should not be confused with a kind of feeble self-effacement. It does not invite us to throw a wet blanket of self-admonishment over any feeling of pleasure at having done something well, with the thought, oh dear, that's the ego. So it's not a false modesty. And again, we come across this thing about energy and vitality in the spiritual life. And this put me in mind of, when I read this, it put me in mind of a passage by a teacher in our movement called Vasatra, who wrote this book called A Guide to the Buddhas. And this passage really stood out strongly for me. And when I was putting this talk together, this material put me in mind of this. And it's sort of on theme, but Vasantra relates it by talking about the fact that, well, I think what comes through really strongly for me in Milarepa's message is he's slowly starting to give the young nobleman the message of, okay, well, you know, you may be a warrior, you may be strong, you may be tough, but actually, if you're going to become my disciple, you really, really need to, you're going to need all your resources. Because, well, if Milarepa's apprenticeship under Marpa was anything to go by, it's not going to be a case of sitting around having tea and scones. So Vasantra talks about this, and he sort of brings it into relationship with what this means for us in the modern day. So Vasantra says, the spiritual life surpasses even the most elevated of worldly states, and it requires at least as much energy and courage to extend the empire of the Dharma as it does to extend a worldly kingdom. Not for nothing did the Buddha say that someone who had gained a spiritual victory over his lower nature had gained a greater victory than that involved in conquering 1,000 men 1,000 times in battle. So the first message of the golden wheel, or the Dharma chakra, a symbol of the Dharma, is that by setting out on the spiritual path, one joins the most noble of all lineages. Without preening ourselves or inflating our egos, if we are practitioners of the Dharma, we should recognize that we need envy no one. So I really like that paragraph because it speaks to me of the courage and the determination that it takes actually to follow the Dharma. And Bhante talks about Buddha pride in his commentary. So it's not an inflated, ego-centered pride, but that we take a pride in the fact that we've made a noble choice in our life. So back to the young nobleman, who this time offers his overcoat. So what do we think happens? Milarepa says, oh, actually, I do need a new... No, he doesn't. So he offers his coat to Milarepa, And Milarepa turns him down. He says, "O'er the cities of the six realms in samsara, with fury blows the evil karmic wind. Driven by the senses and deprived of freedom, one wanders between life and death, roving in bardo. For my part, I aspire to the realm of reality and adorn the cloth of pure mind and heart with the embroidery of immaculate discipline. Mindfulness is the tailor." So again, he takes what the boy has been, the young man has been offering, and he presents it back to him. And at each stage, he's enticing him more and more. So the young nobleman, far from just thinking, "Well, you're never satisfied, you are you? I'm just going to go to this party." It's like he's entranced. He's completely intrigued by Milarepa, and he takes a further step. And he offers him his hat. So he's offered him his horse, his boots, his overcoat. He offers him a jacket as well. But with his hat, it's like he makes his first commitment. There's something symbolic in that, and I'll say why in a moment. But he also, for the first time, offers something of himself. He realizes that material goods aren't going to be enough. So he pays homage to Milarepa. He says, "In summer and in winter, I will follow and pay homage to you." Which is a very strong thing for a nobleman or a warrior of his type. He's basically saying, "Okay, I'm starting to think now about leaving this life behind, and I'm going to follow you." But Milarepa replies to him. He says, "My dear young man, do not lose your head." And he also turns down his hat. He says, "I fear not the element of air within, nor do I depend on falcon's flesh. I feel gay and joyous in a biting wind." So we can see that the young nobleman is starting to feel a sense of devotion. He wants to open himself to Milarepa, but he also recognises that this is he's an enthusiastic young man who may not at the moment be able to fully follow through on that commitment. So he says, "Okay, just take it easy, but I'm also not going to take your hat off you at the moment." And it's symbolic because... for Milarepa, the crown of his head is in a sense already occupied. There's no room for a hat there because he practices guru yoga. So in the Tibetan tradition, he practices by recalling his guru, and he pictures his guru above his head, and he pictures his guru's guru above his head, and so on. And in guru yoga, one allows the blessings of one's teachers and one's teachers to flow down onto him. So it's a deeply symbolic thing, the reason why he's turning it down. So it's the guru that enables transformation. So it's the guru that enables the change to take place, that enabled that change to take place in Milarepa, and that will allow that change to take place in the young nobleman if he proceeds. And this practice is a practice of gratitude. So it's seeing, the central Buddhist principle of Pratitya Samuppada, that everything arises in dependence on conditions. So any change that takes place in us, any move towards the Dharma, has come about because of certain conditions. Because of the fact that we're all interconnected, that we're all affecting each other, and the choices that we make can have a positive impact. So, I'm going to say something about that in a moment, but first of all, I'm going to read what Sangharakshita says about it. He says, the exercise is a simple matter of cultivating, experiencing and expressing gratitude. Gratitude opens us up to the fact of our interconnectedness with others. Whether we enjoy or achieve something, it's salutary to recognise and acknowledge the work and kindness of all the individuals who've contributed to it. But gratitude to the guru has an extra dimension. Because what we're grateful for is beyond valuation. There's no hope of repaying the debt, except by passing the gift on to others. Another way of looking at this is to say that gratitude is a way of opening ourselves up to the merit accrued by the guru, which becomes inextricably linked with our own, as he passes it freely on to us. So we can look at that in relation to the guru, and we can also look at that in relation to our own lives. So we don't have a system of sort of having a guru and a disciple in our tradition. Our emphasis is much more on friendship, and friendship with people who are more spiritually developed than us, friendship with our peers, and offering friendship to people who might be less experienced than we are. And gratitude's been a very strong part of my experience, I think. I find that as I enter deeply into more commitment, I experience gratitude more fully. And I think it's important for us to reflect on the fact that everything that we might take for granted, that I include myself in this, that I sometimes, you know, we're all in danger of taking things for granted, I take things for granted. All of those things have actually been brought about by the hard work of other people. I mean, there's a very inspiring talk on the LBC's YouTube channel at the moment by a man called Attila, who has been in our order since the early 70s. And he was talking about building this centre and what was involved. And it's just incredible, really, actually, how this building is here. You know, it was a derelict, burnt-out, flooded-out fire station at one time, and it was built by a team of people. He was the only person with any building experience when they started. And you had all of these kind of hippies who didn't really know what they were doing, but they had a lot of devotion and a lot of gratitude to their teacher, and they wanted to spread the Dharma. And it took a long, long time, but eventually this centre was built. And I think it's also important to reflect on the gratitude that we might feel for perhaps the person who taught us to meditate or people that have helped us along the way. So I came along to a Tree Ratna centre in 1997. I was taught to meditate by a man called Mangala, who is around the London Sangha, the LBC Sangha. And I'll always feel incredibly grateful to him, because I know that I wouldn't have come across this movement if it wasn't for him opening a centre in Liverpool. And it was the start of a journey of immense joy and riches for me. But what Sangharakshita says here is that, we can't repay that kindness, actually. The only way that we can begin to even think about repaying that kindness is to serve the Dharma, is to pass on what we've learned to other people. And that made me think in my own experience of when I started coming along here. So when I started coming to the London Buddhist Centre, I started coming to Monday nights. And I was welcomed very warmly by Serdik there. The first time, I remember very clearly, the first person I walked through the door, he gave me a very warm welcome. And the people on the team, Sila Peer and other people. And I was very touched by the kindness of people here, and I thought, well, what can I do? What's the best thing to do? So I just joined the team and started helping out. And that's, you know, it's a wonderful way to be here and experience being in the class and get a lot from just helping out and being around. So Sangharakshita talks about this in relation to the Buddhist tradition from the Pali Canon. He talks about the Buddha's most eminent disciple, Shariputra. who made a point of prostrating in gratitude every day of his life to Asaji, the disciple who gave him his first contact with the Dharma. And although Shariputra quickly outstripped Asaji in spiritual attainment, enlightened as he was, he continued to prostrate himself to the still unenlightened Asaji. So there's still that gratitude. It's got nothing to do with who's more spiritually developed or anything like that. It's his gratitude is for the Dharma and for the person who brought him the Dharma. And that put me in mind a little bit of after the Buddha had gained enlightenment, how he had no one to look up to in a sense, because he had achieved, he was the Buddha. He'd refound the path that had been covered over. So he prostrated in front of the Bodhi tree. He was just overwhelmed with gratitude and devotion to this tree that had sheltered him, which I thought was a very, very beautiful image. So, what the young nobleman is offering, you might have noticed, sort of becomes, more symbolic and more refined. At each stage, he's offering something a little bit more. At each stage, he is more... what's the word? He's more enamoured of the Dharma, he's more enamoured of Milarepa's beauty. He sees something wonderful in him, and he wants to move towards that. So the next thing he offers him is, he offers him some jade. So he offers him a jewel. And this is very, it's a very big thing. In the commentary, Sangharaksa talks about the cultural context for that, which even today, if you go to countries like India or Tibet, you'll see people who even might be relatively poor wearing jewels or wearing jewelry or wearing things of value or wearing fine clothes or beautiful clothes. And this is because they carry their wealth with them. And certainly in those days in Tibet, there would have been no thoughts about putting, storing things in a bank or a vault or anything like that. You would carry your jewels or you would carry your finery with you. So it's very, very symbolic that the nobleman offers this to Milarepa, because it might be, it might be the most valuable thing that he owns. So he's finally saying, look, I'll give you this. Please, will you teach me? So what do we think Milarepa says? He says no, and he says no through the gift of song or poetry. So he says, there is no end to human greed. Even with hoarded wealth head high, one cannot reach contentment. I do not envy you your wealth and goods. The greatest treasure is contentment in my heart. The teaching of the whispered lineage is my wealth. My devotion to the Dharma is my ornament. I deck myself with retaining mindfulness. So he says that he has everything he needs. He's completely abundant. And Subhadramati touched on this a couple of weeks ago when she started the series. She put it very, very, very succinctly and very well. That Milarepa's wealth is the Dharma, as specifically as transmitted to him from his lineage. And what that means is that for him, living in a cave, just being clad in a thin white cotton cloth, he's not being deprived of anything. It's not a hardship for him. And this is kind of what we need to get our head around, to begin to imagine a state where we just spontaneously have everything we need. We don't covet anything, we don't crave anything. We know that our inner riches far outstrip anything that the world can offer us. And I think this is pertinent. I mean, it's interesting. I've started teaching in the last couple of years, so teaching meditation and giving the odd talk. And it's funny, one of the questions that I notice comes up quite a lot in people that are fairly new to Buddhism is they ask things like, if I become a Buddhist, what will I have to give up? So what will I still be able to do, and what will I not have to do? So, you know, will I have to go vegan? Will I have to stop drinking? My mum's been expressing an interest in Buddhism recently, and so I won't do Milarepa's songs, but I can do my mum's Welsh accent. So she says, if I become a Buddhist, will I have to stop smoking? So that's her question. You know, will I have to stop smoking? And this is something that comes up a lot. And it's interesting. Well, my response was, well, I'm not sure who's going to stop you smoking, for a start. It's not like there's, you know, God is going to... So we don't have a God in Buddhism, so there's not going to be this hand of God is going to come down and take the cigarette out of your hand. It's more, well, my experience is that the more I practice the Dharma sincerely, the more I really bring all of myself to my practice and devote myself as fully as I can, my experience has been that some of the things that I used to do, like sort of, you know, drinking and things like that, I've just not felt the need for, really, because I've experienced more of an inner sense of abundance and joy, just through practicing the Dharma. So, it's a way of looking at things, isn't it? That from where we are now, we just think, oh well, there's a lot of things that I enjoy doing, like going out clubbing or whatever it is. And I can't imagine my life without those things. But that's because we see from our perspective of where we are now. And actually, from some way down the line, you might just feel that you are ready to let go of those things, or you still do those things, but you approach it with a slightly different frame of mind. I remember being on the winter retreats a few years ago, and somebody was talking to one of the order members there and saying, well, I really enjoy going out clubbing, and I don't want to stop doing that. And he said, well, you don't need to stop doing that. Why would you want to, you know, you don't need to. Just bring awareness to your clubbing. And she was like, yeah, but... And there was lots of kind of yes, but... And he said, just bring mindfulness to it. Really engage with it. Really see what's happening. See how it feels. See what's going on. Bring more consciousness, more awareness to what you're doing, to your activities. And I thought that was a very interesting way of looking at it. Okay. So the young nobleman by this point is really, you know, he's offering more and more. He's really, really opening up, and he changes tack. And what he does is he offers to change his life. So he says that he's prepared to lay down his weapons and open himself to his teacher. He's ready to commit to spiritual life. He says to Milarepa, it's natural for a supreme being like you not to want these illusory possessions. I now offer you my three companions. From now on, I will never carry a weapon or kill sentient beings. I beg you to grant me the ordination. I pray to you to protect me with your compassionate grace. So Sangharakshita says that having acknowledged that the gifts he's offered has no value for the cotton-clad yogi, he now takes a huge step forward. A far more profound ideal has begun to reveal itself to him, and he's ready to reorganize his life in order to attain it. He's beginning, in other words, to take responsibility for his own spiritual life. A decision marked by his asking for ordination, presumably lay ordination, as an upasaka. Having done so, the youth throws himself under Milarepa's care, asking for the protection of his compassionate grace. So this is a profound moment, isn't it? He's saying, okay, not long ago, I was a young nobleman on my way to a party, on my way to have a fun evening. But I've had this incredibly significant encounter with you. I've met the person who I want to be my teacher. I can see something in you that has far greater value than anything I'm going to experience in my life if I carry on the way that I'm going. So he offers himself to Milarepa. He offers himself, well, Sangharakshita says that he offers himself for ordination. He wants his life to go in that direction. He wants to completely change his life. So that's a thing of great significance. So do we think that Milarepa accepts his offer? He doesn't. Not at this time. But he draws him in a little further. He says, "The world without is my quiver. The non-clinging self-illumination within is my sheath of leopard skin. My weapon is the sword of great wisdom. The two-in-one path is my rope. My thumb guard is the merit of meditation. Upon the bowstring of ultimate unborn voidness, I set steady the notch of Bodhi heart. I shoot the arrow of the four infinities at the army of the five poisons." So for the moment, he's not gonna placate this young nobleman, and this is typical of the tantric tradition. He's not going to just be really nice to him and say, "Oh, okay, you know, let's ride off into the sunset." He knows that this young man's got work ahead of him, but nor does he turn him down. He draws him in a little further, and we'll have to wait to see what happens. But it looks fairly clear to me that there's no going back for this young man. He's had a tremendously powerful experience, and his whole vista has been shattered. He's opened up to a life of beauty and wonder that's embodied in Milarepa. And Milarepa, from his part, has incredibly skillfully taken his energies of being a handsome young warrior, and he sort of said to him, "Okay, well, you need to bring all of that onto the path with you if you're going to study with me. If you're going to move to this new life, you're going to need all of that energy and more." So through Milarepa, he's taking up an even more noble and challenging life. And we'll have to wait to see what happens to him. So as I began, I'm going to finish with another song of Milarepa. "Faithful disciples here assembled, ask yourselves, have I practiced Dharma with great earnestness? Has the deepest faith arisen in my heart? He who wants to practice Dharma and gain non-regressive faith should listen to this exposition of the mundane truths and ponder well their meaning. Listen to these parables and metaphors. A painting in gold, flowers of turquoise blue, floods in the vale above, rice in the vale below, abundance of silk, a jewel of value, the crescent moon, and a precious sun. These are the eight similes. No one has sung before such casual words on this. No one can understand their meaning if he heeds not the whole song. The gold painting fades when it's completed. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The lovely flowers of turquoise blue are destroyed in time by frost. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The flood sweeps strongly down the vale above, soon becoming weak and tame in the plain below. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. think, then you will practice the Dharma. Rice grows in the vale below. Soon with a sickle it is reaped. This shows the illusory nature of all things. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. Elegant silken cloth, soon with a knife is cut. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The precious jewel that you cherish soon will belong to others. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. The pale moonbeams soon will fade and vanish. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. A precious son is born. Soon he is lost and gone. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice the Dharma. These are the 8 similes I sing. I hope you will remember and practice them. Affairs and business will drag on forever. So lay them down and practice now the Dharma. If you think tomorrow is the time to practice, suddenly you will find that life has slipped away. Who can tell when death will come? Ever think of this and devote yourselves to Dharma practice.